Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who would you call on if your only daughter was being stalked by a crazed coworker with murder on his mind? Would it be worth getting back in touch with the young woman's hard-boiled detective father, even if he had been out of your life for 30 years? Thankfully, that is not a scenario most of us can even imagine, let alone one we'll ever have to deal with. But it sure makes for a juicy plot in Sandra Brown's latest page-turner, Tough Customer. Amazingly, the book is the 70th in Brown's vastly successful writing career and her 59th book to find a spot on the New York Times bestseller list. Brown took up writing nearly 30 years ago after stints in modeling and in television. She is also a lifelong Texan who was born in Waco, attended TCU, which awarded her an honorary doctorate in 2008, and today makes her home in Arlington. We are pleased to have her with us to talk about her work. Sandra, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
So this story brings back Dodge Hanley, who was in the last novel.
Smash Cut. Yes.
What told you you weren't done with him as a character yet?
I got through with Smash Cut, and I didn't even know Dodge was going to exist when I started writing Smash Cut. He just walked into a scene and made it his own. It's like, you know, a character actor stealing from the lead character. And everything from that scene forward, everything he said, everything he did, I was just totally enamored. And I had developed the biggest crush on him. And I thought when I got finished, I just wasn't quite ready to let him go because he was very cynical, kind of a burnout, a loner. And he lived under the radar, you know, just didn't have that many friends, but he was a real womanizer. So I wondered what made Dodge Dodge, what made him tick. And I started thinking about it. And the more I started thinking about it, I thought he deserves his own story. So that's when I developed the plot for Tough Customer.
Now, a friend of Dodge's, when Dodge says, I'm going to help out my daughter, a friend says, well, you told me a few years ago you didn't have a daughter. Is that because you didn't know Dodge had a daughter back then?
No, I had no way of knowing his history at all when I was writing Smash Cut. He was living merely in the present in that story. And so I had to dig deep and find, because I wanted to know what had turned him so against life and humankind in general. You know, what made him so jaundiced? And so I thought, was he born with kind of this negative disposition, or had it been a series of events, or was it a pivotal event in his life that was life-changing and kind of directed the course of the last 30 years? So when I figured that out, or when it was revealed to me, then I knew he had this child that he had only seen from the hospital nursery. And the woman with whom he had the child, the love of his life, calls and asks for his help. And his initial reaction is, no way, no way, Jose. But then he gets drawn into the crisis very easily and very quickly in the book. I'm not giving anything away.
No, you're not. And he is a good guy. He's easy to like despite
his
craziness.
That's what I loved about him, Chris, is that because for all of his warts, and he has many, psychologically, emotionally, he's a flawed character. And yet, I just loved the heart inside him. And by the end of Tough Customer, I think the reader will find, yes, he has a very tough crust, so to speak, but inside he has a lot of heart, a lot of feeling, and a lot of hurt. There's a lot of pain involved there.
Now, I'm not going to give away any of the plot twists.
Oh, please don't.
For people who are waiting to read the book. But I will say it won't surprise people to know there are some great ones in here.
Thank you.
And I wonder if you always know essentially what those are going to be, or if sometimes you wake up in the middle of the night and think, oh, my gosh, that's it.
Well, I rarely wake up in the middle of the night with a voila moment. but I will be sitting at my computer and the story will be going the way that I thought it was going to go. And then a character will do something or an event will occur that I had no idea was going to happen. And I'll go, oh, whoa, that's so much better than what I thought of. So some of my best plot elements, and some of the best surprises have been enormous surprises to me. And I think that's why writing fiction is such fun for me, because it's going to work every day and waiting to see what's going to happen. And when I'm in the midst of a story and really immersed in it, I don't ever quite leave it. And it kind of annoys me when I have to, because I'm wondering, what are they doing while I'm not there? You know, what am I missing? And I can't wait to get back to it and pick up and see, you know, where it takes me next. So when I do the synopsis for my editor, just so she has a vague notion of what the book is going to be about, I know what the main conflict is going to be. I know several scenes that are going to make it worse, the bad situation worse. I know basically how it's going to end, but I don't know everything. Mm-hmm. And I like it that way, because then it keeps it fresh and new and exciting for me. And I have to entertain myself first, or I know that my reader's not going to be entertained. So I'm a pretty tough critic. And if I'm nodding off the keyboard, then I've got to jumpstart this thing.
What do you think about when do you picture a typical reader? Do you have a girlfriend or a relative or somebody, or do you just sort of in general imagine who wants to read your books?
I think I have to entertain myself first. I write from the gut. I write what I would like to read. I don't really define my reading audience any more than I define my characters. My characters emerge. They come to me and say, write about me. I'm interesting for this reason or another. And sometimes they're just kind of a hazy image. And as we go through the first draft, I get to know them better. It's like any acquaintanceship. You know, you meet someone, you don't know everything about them. You think you do, but they will surprise you. And they don't always fit the mold that you've cast for them. And that's very much the way my characters are. So by the first draft, I know them better. By the end of the second draft, I know them pretty well. And by the end of the book, I feel like I would know them if they walked in the door. I don't cast the book the way a casting director would do a movie. I never imprint someone else's face onto them. They become very real people to me. I know that sounds like I'm certifiable.
No.
It sounds crazy.
You have to do that.
They do become personalities. They really do, and they reveal themselves to me gradually. But when I write a book, my number one goal is to entertain my reader. I don't try to send a message. I don't try to, to preach to anyone. I don't try to impress my feelings about certain things, although I think it's sort of inevitable that every writer develops a voice, and in that voice you're going to hear things that they think and feel. But my main thing is, tell me a story. When I open a book to read, I want it to be great. I want it to be fabulous. I want that reader to take me into another world. That's why I'm reading. And that's the same feeling I hope my readers have, is when they open a Sandra Brown, they think, gee, I want to be entertained. You know, I want to be drawn into another world. And so that's my only criteria. I don't really direct it to anyone specifically.
I love that you started writing flat-out romance novels, because it seems like there's plenty of steam in the thrillers you write, but they're two different styles.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is it entirely different for you when you sit down to write one or the
other? No, not entirely different. I started writing romances because those were the books that were selling at the time. Strictly a commercial decision. I think by just instinct, because I always loved reading, you know, adventure stories, but it always had to have a girl in it, you know, because most books are written from the male point of view. But I always loved the romantic elements. And so when I started writing, I had a published writer read my first few manuscripts, and she said, you know, you really ought to be writing romances. And I didn't know there was a category or a genre specifically, you know, for that. I said, what is it? She said, well, like a Harlequin romance. And I thought, okay. So I went to the store, bought a dozen or so, came back and started reading. I thought, yeah, I can do this. And they were the shorter books. They were published, you know, in a series where each book had the same, you know, format cover, mm-hmm. and the length was dictated and everything. And it was very, very good learning experience because you didn't have time to dilly-dally around. You had to exercise such word economy because every single word had to count. And you had to get into the plot very quickly. You know, you didn't have time to do a travel log.
Yeah.
No, it was what, you know, this is it. You had to get into it right away and present the problem, present the conflict, get on with it. And so I think that those elements of writing fiction that I learned doing the romances, I kind of incorporated when I decided to go into the more suspense, mystery, thriller genre, because it taught me to get into the story quickly. Don't dilly dally, you know, get on with the action. So I feel, but yet the steamy parts, the sensual parts, are just now another element of those books. And I had a lot of practice.
What does it take to write a good sex scene?
Well, my husband would say experience. I would say a really good imagination. But
it's funny
it's
how
like,
that perception is always different.
It's like writing any scene. Are you involved? Mm-hmm. When I'm writing something scary, I mean, my palms sweat. I sit there and my heart accelerates. So it's like, and when I write a very emotional scene, you know, a heart-wrenching scene, I get tears in my eyes. And so it's the same. I think whatever scene you're writing, you have to become emotionally involved or your reader is not going to become emotionally involved. And I want to evoke a visceral reaction from my reader, whether I am writing something scary, something heartbreaking, something sensual, something exciting, whatever it is, I want them to feel it in a very physical way. And that's the way when I'm writing them, you know, I've been known to just break down and sob when someone had to die or when something terrible happened. And I'd say, gosh, what I'm doing to this character is just awful. It just breaks my heart. But as a novel writer, I know that that's what it's going to take to make a really good story.
Now, when you started writing, you had little kids at home, and I'm curious about whether they just got used to hearing mom sobbing in the studio and thinking, oh, she's fine. Or
she's fine. Yeah, she's fine. they didn't understand. They were, I think, 3 and 5 mm-hmm. When I began. And it was like, what are you doing? Well, I'm writing a book. Well, it didn't look like a book. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't have pictures and a cover. It was just a stack of paper. And of course, the older they got, the more they understood. But I tried I bribed them. It was like, okay, if you leave me to write until the big hand gets on the 12 and the little hand gets on, then we'll go swimming, you know, we'll go play, go to a picnic, you know, whatever. There was a treat involved. And I said, and I'll put your name on every page. And that's where I came up with my first pen name, Rachel Ryan. So they kind of got it. Once they saw the first book in print, then they kind of got it. But it was just like every working mother, you know, your kids have to come first. I mean, they do have to come first. You're responsible for these lives, and they're being fed, and they're having clothes to wear, and so on and so forth. But I had a life too. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, if you want to make mommy really happy, let me do this. This is my work. And so it's just like, you know, if I had been a nurse or a teacher or whatever, I would have said, I've got to go to work now. You know, it was just that my uniform was a sweatsuit and I was doing it in the other room, but it was still my work.
Sandra Brown is with us. We're talking about her work and her new novel, Tough Customer. We'll be back in a moment. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Sandra Brown. She has written 70 books. 59 of them, including this one, are on the New York Times bestseller list. The new one is called Tough Customer. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. So the new novel takes place mostly in Houston. And did you actually do sort of site surveys of the places that appear in that book?
Yes, there's a pivotal scene in the Big Thicket, and I have personally never gone into the Big Thicket, but it kind of has that lore, you mm-hmm. know, that folklore and the mystery and the aura of it. And I thought, you know, that would be a good place to really, especially since this novel is so masculine. And feel it's got not only Dodge Hanley from Smash Cut, but he kind of partners with a local sheriff who's a hunka, and he's
Skeen Island. Yeah, it's like such a great name.
And he's a former military, you know, who kind of is rigid, kind of does everything by the book. And so he's the anti-Dodge, but yet they come together and they kind of meld their two different ways of investigating things. And since all that testosterone, you know, was just reverberating, I thought, well, let me get a really physically challenging setting for this. And I thought, oh, the Big Thicket. And I don't remember reading, you know, anything about that area in a long time. So I thought that'd be fun. So I did a lot of research on the Thicket, and I talked to people who do go into it. Yeah, and there are areas, of course, where you can fish and you can canoe and things like that. But there are tens of thousands of acres inside it that are still impenetrable by human beings. And so I thought that'll be a good kind of masculine, challenging set, so to speak.
I think it's interesting in the book, there are some physical descriptions of people, but not as many. It took me a while to realize that you don't tell us exactly what these people look like, and yet I felt like I could imagine that for myself.
I like that, too. Again, it's I hate to be reading a book and I kind of get a shopping list of characterizations, you know, physical characteristics, you know, okay, tall, thin, gray hair, blue eyes, you know, whatever. And I kind of like the character to come out through what they're saying and what they're doing. I want the reader to get more a sense of the individual inside than I do the physical description. And yet sometimes the physical description, there's one character in here, Mr. Mercury, who's kind of, he's kind of comic relief at a very tense time in the book. And I wanted the reader to get a physical sense of him. So I did a little bit more description, you know, the waist length braid down his back, and he's shirtless, and he's, you know, nutty and wrinkled and everything because he goes around, you know, without many clothes on all the time. And I wanted him to be a very real character, or what he was saying and doing wouldn't have been as funny mm-hmm. if you couldn't kind of form a mental image of what
who
he
is
looked
this guy?
Like. Yeah.
There's a funny line in here where I think it's Dodge asks Caroline, how do you
Caroline.
Yeah. Does she have your redhead's temper? And she shouts back, and I have to
I don't
note,
have a temper.
Yeah, exactly. Is that a joke in your family or just a
Well, you might say somewhat. Yeah, somewhat. We have several redheads in our family that haven't been known. Not me, of course, but others.
We had John Irving on last week, and he was talking about the fact that almost beyond his control, he feels like there are certain archetypal characters that appear in a lot of his works. Not the same person, not the same name, but they're the same. Do you feel like you have anything like that?
Oh, very much so.
Falls in?
Very much so. Yes, because I just read a book a few months ago that actually my son, who's just published mm-hmm. his first book, he gave me to read, and it was like, well, I'll humor him. And like three chapters in, I called him and I said, Ryan, thank you so much. And I said, this is fantastic because it addresses the archetypical characters, mm-hmm. you know, And it's like the mentor. Of course, you've got your hero, but you have the trickster. You've got the shapeshifter. You know, you've got, and there are all of these. And I thought, gosh, I didn't know this. And I've written 75, actually.
Oh, 75. Excuse me.
And I thought, but then I started thinking about my books. And I would think about, okay, in Smash Cut, yeah, there were all of these types in there, and it's basic storytelling. It's basic mythology that goes back to Beowulf, you know, or when people first started writing stories down, because the myth has very basic things that happen and very basic characters. And they show up in all forms of fiction, and I wasn't even aware of it. But you take a movie, you take a book, and you start, and you're going like, yeah, that was this character and that, and it's really been interesting to me. So I was doing it by instinct, I suppose, or just from having read thousands of books myself and seeing thousands of movies. And so I knew it, but I didn't know I knew it.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, it always surprises me, and it's, again, I think from the dawn of time, people have had really complicated lives, and yet we love nothing more than reading about other people's complicated lives or watching movies or TV shows. Why do you think our own mess is not enough for us?
Yeah. Well, it's drama. Mm-hmm. It's drama. And human beings, I don't know if it's cathartic to kind of see someone worse off than yourself, or if it really is a cathartic release of emotion that you can become involved, not in your mess, but in somebody else's mess, but it kind of, you know, cleanses you in a way. I don't know what it is, but let's face it, there are areas and situations that just have a dramatic surround. Airports, hospitals, police stations. Of course, these are all very dramatic for me because I write, you know, about crimes being committed. Strife among family members, between siblings, between parents and children, between employers and employees. There are relationships and everything just that are the stage is set for drama. And so I think that people can read a book, and even though if they've never been in that situation, they are thinking subconsciously, oh my gosh, what if I was in that situation? What would I do? How horrible would that be? And they can relate on some level. But I mean, you know, every writer that, you know, we've studied in school depended on the human condition and relationships and people being at cross purposes. That's where conflict arises. Shakespeare knew it. Dickens knew it. I mean, every great storyteller. And the stories, the things we deal with may be different. When you strip it all away, the basic human emotions are the same.
So we relate.
They're the very same. Yes.
You travel a lot. Unlike some of the authors we have in here, you look exactly like the photograph of yourself on the back of your book.
Well, my photographer will be happy to hear that.
How often, Sandra, does it happen that you sit down on an airplane and the person next to you
constantly
pulls out a copy of your book?
Constantly. In fact, I went out to the airport last week to pick up my son and his family who were coming in. And I was sitting there playing Words with Friends on my cell phone. And this lady came by and she said, oh my gosh, aren't you Sandra Brown? And I said, yes, I am. So I stood up, introduced myself. And she said, I read all your books, whatever. And they came off to baggage claim. We got their bags. We're walking out, and my daughter-in-law says, look over there by the window. Look over there by the window. And there was a woman sitting there reading Smash Cut. Mm-hmm. And so because she had it open and she appeared engrossed, mm-hmm, I walked over to her and I said, thank you for reading my book. I think it needs a bookmark, and I happen to have one in my purse, and I gave her. And she was like, oh, my gosh.
She'll be telling that story forever.
Yeah, exactly. But on airplanes, flight attendants and people on airplanes carry books and they read a lot. So I'm frequently recognized in that venue. And I think because also they've got my name in front of them, mm-hmm, you know, it's on their roster. So they see the name, and I, but I, I've given my credit card to people in the department stores, and they go, "Oh, my favorite writer's name is Sandra Brown."
I've heard she's terrific.
And I go, "Oh, well, thank you very much." And they'll go, "Is that you?" You know, because they don't expect it, but yeah.
I can tell you love your work, but I wonder if it's ever a drag to always have that be the thing that you talk about with strangers. We had Clive Cussler on the show, and he was wonderful, but he really only wanted to talk about his classic car collection.
I love Clive. He and I did a panel this summer together, and he's a great gentleman, isn't he?
Yeah, he's wonderful.
Wonderful. He talked more to my husband about cars than he did, than he did about Dirk Pitt. I love my work. I don't talk about it unless somebody asks me. I just don't. I never talk about stories because it's almost like a jinx. You know, you just don't want to verbalize it because then you don't have the compulsion to tell it by writing it down. So I never talk about a story unless it's already published. But no, I don't. I mean, when my friends and I are hanging out or, you know, I don't talk about it unless someone asks a specific question and then I'll tell them about it. But I don't bring it up much to anyone else.
So do the crimes all come from within your own head or do you scan police blotters just for inspiration to think, well, I didn't know somebody could get killed that way?
Half and half. Sometimes it's just my warped imagination. I'll think of something. Sometimes a story idea will come from something that I've read in the newspaper. The best stories come from those little fillers. They're like two paragraphs long, you know, and it's like somebody carries someone's head into, you know,
in a bowling
an institution.
Bag or something.
Yeah, and you're like going, what? Now, what brought those two people to that point? And start putting a, you know, a different spin on it. So those little things can be so intriguing, and they only give you the, you know, the bullet points of the story. And I'm going, no, wait a minute. What's the backstory on that? And then sometimes a story just absolutely comes into my mind and I have no idea where it came from. And I can't explain that. And it can be inspired by a controversy, that something that is in the, you know, the public awareness at that time. And if it interests me, if it interests, you know, enough for nightly news to carry a story about it, then I think, well, people will be thinking about that, you know. So what if took that, you know, that basic premise, but did something different with it? And because one time I remember I saw a show, a talk show about heart transplants. And there was a woman on there who'd received one. She'd never liked fried chicken before. And then all of a sudden, after she got her heart transplant, you know, she's eating fried chicken. And the donor family were on there going, well, that was his favorite food. You
Isn't
know,
that funny?
He, you know. And then the surgeon, the doctor who performed it, said, what a bunch of hooey. You don't transfer, you know, the heart is a pump. You snip, snip, four snips. You put a heart in, you sew it up four places, you know, it's mechanics. But I thought, okay, what if, you know, you recognize, you started loving somebody because of the heart they got. And then I put another twist on it. I thought, what if you hated somebody for the heart that they got? And you weren't killing that person, but you were killing the heart inside them. So
that's good.
Yeah, so that's where I came up with the book called Charade. But it's like taking something that has been discussed or that, you know, is on the in the public forefront, and then I just put a different twist on it or different spin.
Does it bother you at all that you're a guilty pleasure?
Oh, no, I love being guilty pleasure. Mm-hmm. I love being a guilty pleasure. I'd love to be like Brad Pitt's guilty pleasure. In the books, of course. I'd love him to be. No, but I love it when people say, oh, my gosh, you know, you're my beach book of the summer. I read you on the subway. I read you in the bathtub. You know, I love being someone's guilty pleasure because I know the pleasure that I derive from reading a book. And as I said earlier, when I open one, I want it to be fabulous. I want it to be terrific. I want to be able not to put it down. And that's the same feeling I want from my readers. I'm not trying to be lofty. I'd much rather be the book where the cover's bent, the pages are curled, they've got suntan oil, Coca-Cola, you know, they look like they've been through the ringer, because that means they've been read. And yeah. they've been read when somebody was having a good time. That's so much more important to me than winning a prize and staying on some college shelf and collecting dust. I want to be read. That's why I'm writing, you know, to be read and bring entertainment to people.
I do think it's funny. There are all different kinds of movies and all different kinds of TV shows and all different kinds of books. It seems like books are that one thing that people feel like they ought not, if they are reading, they ought to be reading something very serious. And I read a lot of serious stuff myself.
Life is too short.
I think everybody needs to unwind sometimes. And it's funny, right. though, that somehow people don't want anyone to know. The smartest girl I ever went to school with, you know, PhD from MIT, would always have a Harlequin romance or some kind of thriller tucked into her backpack.
It's her escapism.
It was, yeah. And mm-hmm. I think I learned from her that that was okay, and it's nothing to be ashamed of. It's just fun.
Right. Well, we've had Cinderella and stories like that around for a long, long time. And they've endured for a very good reason. And that's because people derive a great deal of entertainment and pleasure from them. So, you know, it's I don't really, and you can't say I don't care what a child is reading so long as they're reading, because, of course, we wouldn't want them reading hardcore pornography. But I don't think that parents should get too upset if their children are absolutely stuck on Harry Potter or stuck on Nancy Drew or stuck on something. They're cultivating that habit, and eventually they're going to trade those books in for something else. They're going to go on to another venture, because I was a Nancy Drew junkie. Mm-hmm. I mean, I read
them. Oh, that's fascinating.
I read them 10 times a piece, mm-hmm. and went, I couldn't wait for the next one to come out. And I turned out okay. I mean, I grew to read other things mm-hmm. and more mature things and things that were good for me. And then when I got, you know, in high school, I was reading all of Dickens. And then I was reading all of, you know, this author, that author. I couldn't get enough. And so I think what's really important is to cultivate the habit of reading. Not so much what you're reading. If it's comic books, that's fine. They're still reading.
Novelist Sandra Brown is my guest. She has just published her 75th book. It's called Tough Customer. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is novelist Sandra Brown. She has just published her 75th book, 59th, is 59th correct?
On
the
yes, best,
on
that
the
is
New
right.
York Times bestseller list. Amazing. The new one is called Tough Customer. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk about the scholarship that you and your husband funded at TCU.
Yes, that's a project very near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, this is really, it's amazing how it came about. And it's also the thing that I was drawn to was it's for an aspiring young writer. And one of the qualities that the selection committee looks for is discipline. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about why that was so important to you.
We do. It was really Michael, my husband Michael's brainchild. He surprised me with it, actually. And I was thrilled, because when I went to school, I had to have a scholarship in order to go. And I gave it up in order to get married. Now, this goes back 42 years as of this month.
That was the law, or that was the rule of the scholarship. You couldn't be married and have it.
And so school was a struggle from then on. I had to give it up. And so I really wanted to, he and I really wanted to do something for writing students, something that it would be a life-changing advantage mm-hmm. for them. Because writers, you know, sometimes have to work years and years and years before, you know, you don't fill out an application and right. become a writer. And so the reason that we made it for rising juniors is it would be available for their junior and senior year, divided in half. And the reason for that was that we wanted someone who was really serious, who had proved to their faculty the first 2 years that they were serious about this. And it's not only TCU students. It's open to any students for transfer into TCU to apply for the scholarship. Mm-hmm. So we wanted it to show that they had the discipline, that they had the chops. And they have to submit a portfolio of 100 pages of fiction. And it can be several stories. It can be the first several chapters of a novel. But they have to kind of show that they have the discipline and the fire in their belly for fiction writing. And this is a pretty good indicator, because with all of their other subjects, 100 pages is quite a lot. I know. And but I said, I think that's fundamental, because talent is great. That's a God-given thing, but it takes self-discipline to sit down and hone that talent and use that talent. And some of the most talented people in the world will never write a book because they don't have the self-discipline to do it. And so I thought it was extremely important to show, for the students to show that they did have the discipline. And we've awarded two so far, one to a young woman who was a TCU student. This year's recipient is a young man named Travis Freeman, and he's an older student. He's 26, and he's transferring from Austin Community College to accept the scholarship. So we're really proud of that. And our first student, Kelly, has already published a piece of fiction in a magazine. So,
oh, that's amazing.
Yes, we're really thrilled.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Tasha in Dallas. Hi, Tasha.
Hi. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Tasha.
I'm Ms. Brown. How are you guys doing?
Very well, thanks.
I just wanted to say that I loved what you said about your characters on how you create them. And them revealing themselves to you. I like to write as well. And one thing that I like to do is when I write, I'll read to my sister over the phone at night. And I told her one night, I said, I'm so excited. I can't wait to see what happens. And she's like, don't you realize that you're writing it? So my question is, do you get that? Do you feel like the book is revealing itself to you and you kind of don't know where it's going and it's a ride for you too?
Absolutely, Tasha. When I send a synopsis to my editor, I know the main points of the book. I know what the initial conflict is going to be. And I know several key scenes that are going to make that conflict worse. And then usually I know how the book is going to end. But some of the best plot elements that have ever come to me, and some of the best surprises I didn't see coming. And a character would do something or something would happen, and it would occur to me literally while my fingertips were on the computer keys. And I would think, oh, that's great. and so I sometimes feel guilty. People say, you wrote such a great book. How did you ever come up with that? And there's really no way in which you can explain it to someone who doesn't write fiction that sometimes characters and the plot reveal themselves to you gradually.
What's the difference, Sandra, between a good day at work for you and a bad day?
Some days I can't type fast enough. Mm-hmm. Some days it's just flowing. And then other days it's like my characters are standing there. I visualize as I'm writing. So it's like I'm watching a play and I see what they're doing. And if he stands up and moves over to the mantle and fiddles with something, or if she is adjusting something, I see them do that and I write it down. I hear what they say and I write it down. Some days they're standing there looking back at me going like, well, you've put us in this situation. What are we supposed to do? Give us a hint. And those are bad days. So some days I can do 18 pages before I come up for air. Mm. And some days I'm lucky to get three. It just depends, and there's no rhyme or reason. Sometimes, and many over the past 30 years that I've been doing this, I mean, life has interfered. I've had illness in my family, deaths in my family, births of grandchildren, and I was forced to take, you know, time off and handle these, you know, ups and downs in life. But I've always relied on my work to keep me kind of grounded. And when, you know, have a terminally ill parent, dealing with all of that, the work was actually an escape for me. Mm-hmm. I found that I could go to work and I could deal with someone else's problem and for a little while put mine aside. And so instead of just falling completely apart and going insane with what was happening, that kept me kind of anchored. And you know, I had later agents and editors say, how in the world did you write this during this time? But I did what I had to do. And I take that responsibility, you know, very seriously. But I, in a way, it was good escapism for me, too.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next, we have Adam in Plano. Hey, Adam.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Hi, Adam.
Hey, I've got a question. I'm kind of blogging my way into a book, and I've got a trademark application. The trademark is almost complete. But I feel like what I'm missing is the kind of direction and editing, you know, like almost like I got in school, but almost like a writer's club or something. And I haven't found anything like that yet that works with my schedule because I work full-time. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I've got the discipline part, and the blogging makes it easier because it's like I can write one kind of five-paragraph essay per night and see it kind of come together day by day. But then it's like I'm kind of going, okay, and what next?
Right. Well, there are some local chapters of some national writing groups, for instance, Mystery Writers. Now, I'm only speaking from my experience as a fiction writer. I don't know about nonfiction. It sounds like if you're writing essays, it's more nonfiction. I would recommend if you're really writing to sell that you start shopping for an agent because at the time I began, the market was not quite as closed as it is now to beginning authors and more books. Quantity-wise, were being published, and so a writer who did not have an agent could sometimes, you know, come in through the transom, they call it, over the transom, but now it's really almost vital, almost compulsory that your work is represented because publishers are not publishing the quantity that they once did, and an agent would be a real good gauge of if your work is publishable or if it needs to, you know, have another run through or two. So I would start looking for an agent. And if you just do Google search for literary representatives or writers agents, you'll get, you know, hundreds of websites, and most are very reputable. Don't be put off if they charge a fee, because some even really, really reputable agents are now forced to charge a fee to read it. We're talking about maybe a couple of $100s. But I would recommend the next step at this point is to maybe see if you could find a local writers group, which is really good, a critique group. And typically they have ads for those in the back of like the Writer's Digest or the Writer. And you can buy those at a bookstore. And look in the want ads, and usually you can find, you know, links to that kind of thing. So good luck to you, Adam.
How different was it for you the first time you decided not to use a pen name and to have Sandra Brown on the cover of a book?
I was writing at the time for three different publishers under three different names, and I had a fourth publisher ask me if I would write for her romance line. And I thought, okay, this keeping up with different names is ridiculous. So I'm just going to start writing under Sandra Brown. And I accused Michael of enjoying sleeping with a different woman every night a little too much. So I said, okay, from now on, you know, it's all Sandra Brown. And it was kind of liberating in a way, actually. You know, I liked using my own name.
And so you mentioned earlier that your son Ryan is a novelist now. He published a book in May.
Uh-huh. Play Dead.
That must be really gratifying.
It is. It is. I don't know if I've done him any favors or if I'm really cursed him, but he got the writing bug several years ago, and he started, you know, working on these novels, and his imagination is just unbelievable. And Play Dead is about a Texas high school football team who come back as zombies to play their championship game. So
a little more guilty pleasure, right there.
I mean, as I said, it's someone said, "Is it fiction?" I said, "I think so," but it's great. I mean, it's funny. It's really a satire on steroidal use. Mm-hmm. And he said when he was doing this process, it was like, you know, all these juiced up, you know, kids playing football, and it would be, what would it take to defeat a team of monsters, except real monsters? Mm-hmm. So that's where he came up with the plot, but it's very clever, and it comes out in a trade paperback version in the middle of October. And so he's now going to zombie crawls. And he didn't really set out to write a zombie book. In fact, the word zombie never appears in the novel. But it's fun. And he's working on his second one. He's just finished it, actually. So it should come out next spring.
It's got to be nice to be able to share that. But I would imagine you also know exactly
the agony and the ecstasy.
Yeah.
It is. And he was here this past weekend. And after everyone else went to bed at night, he and I were still up, you know, for a couple of hours just talking about, you know, this, that, and the other, about writing and then the publishing industry and everything. So it's I haven't even read the second book. He won't even let me read it. I read the first draft of Play Dead, and I gave him notes. But after that, I didn't even read it until it was published. He's been fiercely independent. Mm-hmm. And this time round, he told me the other day, you know, he turned in his book and he was going on vacation after that. He'd worked really hard to meet his deadline. And I said, well, when am I going to get to read it? And he said, this time, I really don't want you to read it until after I've gotten my own notes from my editor and everything. And I said, I really respect that, Ryan. You know, he's been almost resistant, almost too much the other way in terms of refusing any help whatsoever. But when I give him criticism or when I give him advice, he listens. And we can talk now, not just like mother, son, but as colleagues, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Sandra Brown has just released her 75th novel. The thriller is called Tough Customer. Sandra, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, this has been great. Thank you so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.